Sit down, grab a beer, talk macroeconomic policy. Good, right? What? Doesn't sound good to you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 12th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with some of the economic underpinnings of the presidency of Donald J. Trump to this point, as expressed by his budget director, Mick Mulvaney. Mulvaney sat down with John Harwood of CNBC and The New York Times the other day, literally over a beer, by the way. So Harwood is doing something right to talk things over. They went for a while. We are going to pick just a couple of things and tease them out a little bit. First of all, the news out of the Office of Management and Budget, the lifting of the federal hiring freeze and the state of the federal workforce. Here is Mulvaney with one quick caveat that I have to give you. They were in a bar, Harwood and Mulvaney were enjoying the aforementioned beer, so it's a bit noisy. Here you go.
The professional staff, the folks who are here for 10, 20, sometimes 30, I think there's been a couple folks there since the 1970s. Have really stepped it up. It may be the deep state, it may be whatever you want to call it. Yeah. All I know is that I go into these meetings and I have discussions with these folks about my budget, and I cannot tell which one of them is a Democrat or Republican, and that's the way it's
supposed to be. You're pleased by what you've found.
Absolutely.
Unsaid in that bit is the point that, end of the hiring freeze or not, President Trump wants to make the federal workforce smaller by a lot. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains how that might go.
So the federal government can start hiring again, but most federal agencies still have to trim their staffs. The memorandum lifting the freeze says they have until June 30th to submit draft plans to reduce their workforces.
The emphasis should less be on slashing staff than aligning staff against the priorities that you have.
Max Steyer heads the Partnership for Public Service, a nonprofit that works for more effective government. He says the Trump administration can only make nips and tucks with things like federal hiring freezes.
You have to dance with Congress in order to get real change done in the government.
That's because Congress wrote the laws governing the civil service. If you wanted to, say, abolish a federal agency, you'd have to get Capitol Hill's buy-in, because Congress created that agency. That buy-in might not be so easy because some lawmakers have big job-creating federal agencies in their districts. Paul Light is a professor of public service at New York University.
Federal employees are spread across the United States. More than 80% of them work outside of Washington.
Also, Congress wouldn't want huge cuts to federal workers providing services that their constituents depend on, like Social Security checks. Jack Pitney is a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College.
If there are backlogs in processing various kinds of benefits, members of Congress are going to hear about it.
Pitney says there's a gap between the Trump administration's plans for the federal workforce and reality. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Another big promise from the Trump administration has been infrastructure spending. Harwood asked Mulvaney about that as well. And what you have to know as you hear this next piece of tape is that Mulvaney is what's known as a budget hawk, doesn't like a whole lot of federal spending, and infrastructure spending, $1 trillion over a decade, according to the most recent White House plan, is, well, you know, it's fine.
Infrastructure is sort of that good spending in the middle, where even if you do misallocate resources a little bit, you still have something to show for it. It's tangible. It may help economic growth and so forth.
Marketplace's Jed Kim is on the infrastructure desk today.
$1 trillion for infrastructure? That sounds like a lot of money. But Brian Palish with the American Society of Civil Engineers says, keep in mind that trillion's over 10 years. And we need double that.
The unmet investment needs are $2 trillion over the next 10 years.
The society gives a letter grade to U.S. infrastructure. Right now, it's a D+. The trillion mark isn't all government spending. It depends on public-private partnerships. Palish says there are much-needed projects that won't appeal much to the private sector.
If you're going to repair bridges or repair dams, and there's plenty of that that needs to be done, it's harder to find the return on investment.
Not everything is a toll road or a toll bridge. The Trump administration wants tax credits for infrastructure. Jess Feinberg is with management consultant Woodlawn Associates. He says there's no telling how many projects would qualify, and no telling how much demand from investors who buy such tax credits.
These folks tend not to have the tax appetite necessary to monetize a tax credit on the scale that the Trump campaign proposed.
We might only get to $1 trillion if those tax credits sell like hotcakes. The White House also wants to strip funding from the federal agencies that handle infrastructure, like the Army Corps. It says a new executive office can do projects faster. Congress will have to sign off on all of it. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Finally, from the Mulvaney Harwood Chronicles, the federal debt and the size thereof. As you remember, probably, candidate Trump promised to get rid of the federal debt over two terms in the White House. President Trump's budget director says, yeah, no.
I think it's fairly safe to assume that that was hyperbole. When I'm not going to be able to pay off $20 trillion worth of debt in 4 years. I'd be being dishonest with you if I said that I could.
Yeah.
The reason the president doesn't want to raise some or change some of the mandatory spending, the public's not ready for it yet. They're ready for economic growth.
Marketplace's Mariel Segarra picks up on that last bit, learning to love growth and not worrying about the federal debt.
Getting rid of $20 trillion of debt over 4 years or even 8 years is not really possible. It's hard enough to pass a balanced budget in any given year. Joanne Weiner teaches economics at George Washington University.
No one wants to cut spending. No one wants to raise taxes. So how are you going to even get to a budget surplus, much less pay down the debt?
So if you take eliminating the debt off the table, what does that free the Trump administration up to do? For one thing, it might cut taxes, as President Trump has promised. Robert Bixby is the executive director of the Concord Coalition, a nonpartisan fiscal responsibility advocacy group.
They may be trying to give themselves some room for a big tax cut, because certainly if you're trying to pay off the debt, there's no room for a tax cut.
The Trump administration has also promised big economic growth. Backing off this plan to eliminate the debt could help with that. Rob Shapiro from Georgetown University and the economic advisory firm Sonicon says getting rid of the debt would require drastic spending cuts that would slow the economy.
When we spend money on defense, when we spend money on Social Security, on education, that money goes to companies or individuals who then spend it.
And now the president might be able to hold on to entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare, which he promised to preserve. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Quick shout out to John Harwood and CNBC for all that Mulvaney tape, by the way. Of course, he probably expensed the beer. CNBC probably paid. I don't know. Traders didn't know which way to turn today. The Mulvaney thing, the president on China and currency and some other stuff. We will have the details, you know, later. We've talked quite a bit on the program of late about real-world retail and its malaise in the face of consumers doing more and more of their shopping online. Malls, in particular, are struggling as their anchor stores like Sears and Macy's are shutting down. But at least one part of the brick-and-mortar retail industry is still thriving: outlet malls. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has that story.
The Promenade Mall in Woodland Hills in L.A.'s San Fernando Valley is dead on a recent Saturday afternoon. It's been struggling for years, and it's due to be demolished soon. A movie theater and some restaurants are still open, but almost all the shops are closed. The only people inside are a group of young girls running around and filming each other with iPhones. I asked one of their moms what's up.
Because it's completely abandoned. They're playing zombie. Here they come.
Marcilla Pittman says she's watched her neighborhood mall slowly fall apart.
Macy's was fantastic, and then they closed the Macy's. I can't even believe even the food court's closed.
Its owner, Westfield, is one of the largest mall companies in the world, but it won't be putting another mall here. Westfield is developing a $1.5 billion urban community with apartments, office towers, and a stadium instead. 15 miles up the 101 freeway at the Camarillo Premium Outlet Mall, it's a different world. Antsy drivers are making giant laps around the packed parking lot.
We come over here maybe once or twice a year when there's a good sale.
Alexis Rodriguez is holding bags of bags, new handbags from the Coach store. Ryan Newton drove an hour to this open-air shopping center. He says he's here for
discounts, the weather, and, just a little outing.
In the past 5 years, sales at outlet malls have doubled to about $50 billion, according to Green Street Advisors. USC clinical marketing professor Lars Perner says shoppers are seeking an experience, like the thrill of bargain hunting.
The outlet store malls that you don't see every day maintain much more of a mystique. They don't have the same familiarity, and there's something new to be found every time.
Developers have also been savvy, building outlets in places where people are already in the market for experiences, like near theme parks. They've also made them easy to get to, putting them just off busy highways. Suzanne Mulvey at CoStar says other developers are catching on.
Since 2013, we've added about 30 new outlet centers around the U.S. We've probably built 3 malls.
Retailers have found that when it comes to bricks and mortar, outlets are a better bet. They've become the most profitable distribution channel for some brands. That's partly because rents in outdoor malls are way cheaper than their temperature-controlled counterparts, says outlet industry consultant David Hinkle.
Then you couple the fact with many brands' sales performance out of their outlet stores exceed what they do in enclosed malls, and then it just becomes a good math problem.
The numbers work, Hinkle says, because shoppers are showing up and behaving differently than they do in other shopping centers.
The dwell time is longer. They typically bring more people with them. They shop more stores and they buy more.
Back at the Camarillo Outlet Mall, Gary Milbrox is resting on a wooden bench surrounded by Nike and Ralph Lauren shopping bags. He tells me that his job is running an online clothing store. So why is he shopping the good old-fashioned way?
Online for me, I think, is more of like when you have to get something either last minute or you don't feel like going out. But if you're looking for the outing or shopping, walking around, retail stores is the more fun part.
The challenge for outlet malls will be to maintain shoppers' excitement. Remember, once upon a time, traditional malls were the place to be. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Healthcare reform is, by all appearances, on its last legs, even though the president did say on Fox Business this morning that he would like to get healthcare done before he turns to taxes. However the next few weeks go, though, it is not news that the American healthcare economy is in some distress. Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News and also now the author of a new book about how we might revive healthcare in this country. It's called An American Sickness. Thanks for coming on the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You are a physician. You're a journalist as well of many years. You know whereof you speak on this topic. Why then spend more time on it in this book, figuring out how to let people take healthcare back?
Well, because I think the system is really broken right now. I've done a lot of work in social media with my journalism, and I just keep hearing these stories that are so distressing to me. People feel like they're victims, like there's very little they can do, like they're kind of cogs in this big machine, and they're mostly satisfied with their health care, but they can't bear the cost anymore.
Without getting too political, do you think a solution to the current state of American health care necessitates Congress and the White House doing something, either when Obamacare was coming or now that Paul Ryan and Donald Trump want to do something?
Well, I think the all-or-nothing approach is kind of dangerous, as we've seen, because we felt we had one all, and then that went away, and now we're trying to figure out another all. And healthcare is kind of a Rubik's Cube. It's really hard to get it all at once. Beyond that, a lot happens in healthcare at the state level, at your local hospital level. So I think there's a lot we can ask for without depending on Congress to kind of come in with one big, quick fix, because as we've seen, that ain't going to happen right now.
Okay, so how much can I actually do if, you know, prescription medications are $2,000 a month and I'm making $1,500 or whatever it is? I mean, there's a certain financial reality here that can't be overcome just by saying people need to do more for their own health care.
Right. And I think this narrative that we're into now is people have to be better consumers of healthcare. It's kind of a false narrative because most of the time, hey, you know, your doctor says you need a test or you need a prescription and you can't find the price of that anywhere before you buy it. That being said, there are things you can do to protect yourself in this system, which I think we just don't feel entitled to do. If my doctor says to me, oh, you need a knee x-ray, I'll say, please direct me to the center that's qualified, that does a good job, but that has the lowest price.
But then the doctor's going to say, yeah, no, I'm sorry, Elizabeth, that's not my job. You're the consumer. You figure it out. And I can see you throwing your hands up right now because that's what I would do.
Well, I think that's kind of a cop-out from doctors, having been one. And I think, you know, part of the asking is that if everyone asks, then it will be part of their job to know, right? They'll have to know it. we're paying twice as much as most other developed countries without getting better results. And, you know, our current president is a deal maker. We're getting a bad deal.
I know I said I didn't want to talk about the politicization of medicine too much when I talked about Obamacare and the current GOP plan, but do you worry that medicine has become too politicized and that that is the barrier to change?
Well, the first thing I worry about is that it's become too commercialized.
Oh, yeah.
Before I talk about the politics, I think one of the things I've seen in my lifetime, and, you know, as you said, I was a physician or I am a physician. My dad was a physician, is the infusion into this caring profession of commercial values, so that so much of what happens to us when we get care is defined by the finances of it rather than the caring and the science of it. And, you know, trying to get the commercial part out of it now is really, really tough. That's part of why the politics is tough, right? Because, I mean, we see at the town halls now as there's the debate going back and forth between the people who favor the ACA and the new GOP plans, people just standing up and saying, hey, this isn't working for me. I mean, there are a lot of solutions that will work, and what we can't keep doing is choosing none of them.
Elizabeth Rosenthal, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, wrote for The New York Times for many years. She is now the editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News. Her book is called An American Sickness. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up.
You know, there's a lot of confusion and chaos, at least in some agencies, about what exactly the role of these beachhead officials are.
Who's doing what in Washington? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 59 points today, just a bit more than a quarter of 1%, 20,591. The NASDAQ off 30 points, about a half percent, 58.36. The S&P 500 dropped 8 points, 0.3%, 23.44. We hit them all in today's show. Stock in Tanger Factory Outlet Centers up 0.4%. CBL, it owns dozens of regular malls. It's up about 0.5%. Simon Property Group, regular malls and outlets there, didn't really move much at all. U.S. Steel says a failed pipe caused a toxic chemical spill into an Indiana River right next to Lake Michigan. Its stock fell nearly 10% on that news. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note dropped to 2.24%. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
We host a podcast called Make Me Smart.
And you have a lot of questions for us about business and technology.
Is automation going to take over even white-collar careers?
Do we actually make enough steel to construct large-scale infrastructure projects?
What is IBM Watson?
Watson, turns out, is a supercomputer that can probably beat you at chess and might even help you with your taxes.
Want to know more? I know you do. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. For a long time, it kind of felt like Hollywood was becoming more of a state of mind than the actual center of the American entertainment industry. States and other countries, for that matter, offered film producers all kinds of incentives and tax credits and lured hundreds of millions of dollars worth of production away from Los Angeles. So it was big news this week when Netflix, producer of something like $6 billion in original content this year, said it's going to invest in building its infrastructure in California. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has more now on the state of film tax credits and the appeal of staying in Hollywood.
Some of us may have trouble finding the small town of Sonoya, Georgia on a map, but odds are any state lawmaker could, and that's because of this creepy moneymaker.
We already started this, and we're going to win, whatever it takes.
The Walking Dead is among dozens of productions that have been lured to Georgia with rich tax credits, sometimes up to 30%.
And incentives have become a key aspect of every production. I mean, producers today, when they're budgeting a movie, they do about 6 to sometimes 10 budgets based on different locations.
Joe Kianese heads up Entertainment Partners, a production service company. He says about a decade ago, nearly every state offered incentives. But as the stakes rose,
some states economically couldn't afford to maintain their programs. Other states decided that they wanted to allocate their funding to other places.
Today, about 35 states are still in the game. Netflix's decision to concentrate its production in California will cost the company. But Vicky Mayer, a communications professor at Tulane University, says by creating its own studios,
they have the infrastructure, they have the equipment, they have the crews that they can fund.
Staying in Hollywood could also give Netflix an edge with actors and directors who won't have to leave their families. Nancy Ray Stone is with the California Film and Television Tax Credit Program. She says Hollywood shouldn't get too giddy yet.
We certainly are still losing productions to other locales. Georgia, Louisiana are very popular.
And New York isn't going anywhere. That's why 2 years ago, California expanded its own tax incentives. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
The number of the day today is 531. According to the Washington Post and the Partnership for Public Service, that's the number of appointments to key Senate-confirmable jobs that the White House still has to make. But when the Trump transition team became the Trump administration, they put about 400 staffers in jobs across the various federal departments and agencies, and a lot of those people are still there doing, well, that's a good question. Justin Elliott covers government accountability for ProPublica, which has been covering this. Justin, good to have you on.
Good to be here.
So if the regular staff positions, as it were, are mostly empty at the presidential appointment level, who then has President Trump installed across the government?
So my colleagues and I obtained through a public records request a list of over 400 political appointees who have been installed at federal agencies from the Department of Agriculture to the Pentagon. And these are people on what the Trump administration is calling beachhead teams. And there's a lot we don't know about their role. But in some agencies, these are the only really representatives of the new administration.
Are they there to carry out the effective functioning of government? Are they the White House's eyes and ears in the government agencies and departments? Why are they there?
You know, it seems to be some combination of both. Again, we have a lot of unanswered questions about this. But, for example, at each of the agencies, there are people with the title of White House liaison. Hmm. They actually apparently report back to the White House regularly on what's going on in the agencies. You know, I've also heard from career federal employees who reached out to us after we published our story that, you know, there's a lot of confusion and chaos, at least in some agencies, about what exactly the role of these beachhead officials are. But there are also policy changes happening at some of these agencies, even the ones that don't have cabinet appointees yet.
Who are these folks? I mean, give me a couple of for examples here.
Sure. So my colleagues and I at ProPublica analyzed this list of more than 400 names, and I would say the biggest finding is there are literally dozens of people who are lobbyists or were lobbyists until they were hired by the administration. To give one example, there's a gentleman at the Department of Labor named Jeff Burr who, until he got this job, was the chief lobbyist of the Construction Industry Trade Association in Washington. Hmm. Mr. Burr used to lobby the department on wage issues, workplace safety issues, and now he has a government job in the department and presumably has some sort of role in setting policy. So there's at least around 36 people like that.
And of course, the president said during the campaign and during the transition period, no lobbyists, didn't he?
Right. He was asked directly a couple times in the campaign about hiring lobbyists. At one point, he said he quote, wouldn't have a problem not hiring lobbyists. So we've seen a complete 180 from that statement during the campaign. You know, I think these beachhead officials are also interesting because they're not Senate confirmed. I mean, the Senate confirmation process mm-hmm. sort of allows for two things. One is it allows senators to quiz the appointees about the administration's policy priorities on in whatever the area is. And the second is it allows for an examination of these people's pasts. I mean, we saw with Andrew Puzder, the nominee for Labor Secretary, mm-hmm. he didn't make it through the Senate confirmation process because things came out about domestic violence allegations, alleged mistreatment of workers at his company. And so he dropped out. These beachhead people, we were only able to get their names through public records requests. Mm-hmm. And I've been reporting on who some of these people are in the last several weeks. And some of them have been involved in scandals in the past, have colorful pasts.
Justin Elliott at ProPublica covering politics and government accountability there. Justin, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot. We'll be right back.
This final note on the way out today, back to whence we came, macroeconomic policy. This time, though, from Mick Mulvaney's boss. President Trump said a couple of interesting things in an interview with the Wall Street Journal today, talking specifically about currency. First of all, the White House is not going to name China a currency manipulator in a report due out in a couple of days. That is as candidate Trump threatened to do repeatedly on day one on the campaign trail. Also about the sustained strength of the U.S. dollar, the president said this, quote, look, there's some very good things about a strong dollar, but usually speaking, the best thing about it is that it sounds good. End of quote. Fact check on that, by the way, that is actually true. Dow off 59 points today, about a quarter of 1%. NASDAQ off 30 points, about a half percent. The S&P 500 lost 8 points, 3 tenths of 1%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.